You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, protests grow in France, TikTok goes to Congress, and Israel receives a rare rebuke from its strongest ally. It's a Friday news roundup today at 6 on 1A+. Now, President Biden released his budget proposal last month, and Congress is on the clock with a deadline to release budget plans by April 15th. The Democratic president and the Republican House are likely to have big differences, and there's a risk of a debt ceiling standoff over key issues. And looming over all of that, a big national debt, over $31 trillion worth, and concerns about annual deficits adding to that tally. Our next guest is with a federal budget watchdog group, with us for a look at tax and spending alternatives and what they would mean for the debt. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about the national debt? Are there things you want to see change on the tax or spending sides of things? Are there changes that should be off the table? Social Security, the Trump-era tax cuts? Or are there tax spending cuts or tax increases you do want to see? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. Mark Goldwine is Senior Vice President and Senior Policy Director at the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. Mark, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I gave a very broad number there. Can you give us the current state of the debt and the direction it's moving in?
Oh, well, it is not pretty. I like to measure the debt relative to the size of the economy, and it's pretty close. It's at about 97-98%. Within 5 years, the debt is going to be at a new record, 106, even higher than it was after World War II.
How big an impact did COVID-related emergency spending have?
So in total, we spent about $5 trillion on COVID-related emergencies, which is a good 10% of the economy. And so without, you know, everything, all those numbers I told you, that 106, maybe it would be 95 without the COVID emergency, which is still quite high.
We see often parties when they come into power being less worried about debt than when they're out of power. Why should we take this debt seriously, no matter which political party might be running the White House and Congress?
Yeah, I do think that's the huge political problem, right? Is Republicans love cutting taxes, Democrats love increasing spending, and they love beating each other over the head over adding to the deficit, but not really looking in the mirror. The problem is, everyone's looking at the next election. Nobody's looking at the next generation. And this debt really starts to eat at our economic growth. It's part of the reason inflation is so high right now because of that deficit spending. And it's part of the reason that interest rates are rising.
We have the president's budget proposal. It offers, at least they claim, about $3 trillion in deficit reduction over 10 years. Does it do that, or at least ish? And if so, where is that coming from?
Ish. So first of all, $3 trillion would be a really good start. We would need about $16 trillion to balance the budget. We need about $8 trillion to stabilize the debt, which I think is what our goal should be. So $3 trillion is not a drop in the bucket. It's a real start, but it's only a start. The president's budget gets there mainly through tax increases. They actually have about $5 trillion of tax increases, along with about $500 billion of savings from the spending side. But they spend a lot of that on new initiatives for childcare, for college, for healthcare, you name it. And so they're left with $3 trillion. That $3 trillion, you know, I think an independent estimate would come up with more like two, but it's real deficit reduction.
Now, the president's budget doesn't matter if Congress doesn't pass it. Republicans control one of the chambers of Congress. Now, there's this April 15th deadline. They're supposed to have a congressional budget. But we don't seem to take our budgeting real seriously anymore in terms of meeting deadlines and that sort of thing.
That's right. The president was a month late with his budget. Congress, I've heard some rumors, is not even going to try to put forward a budget, which is pretty nuts. We haven't had we haven't seriously used the budget process to actually try to figure out our tax and spending priorities in 15 years or so. The budget process is so broken that we're lucky if we can actually avoid a government shutdown before October 1st.
That's the shutdown. And then there's this debt ceiling thing, ideas floating for some Republicans in the House to use the debt ceiling as a way to get some spending cuts. Now, some Republican leaders say, no, we're not going to do that. What do you think of that as a tactic to say, okay, we're going to risk this big debt ceiling chaos if we don't get the cuts that we want?
Well, first of all, the U.S. absolutely, without equivocation, needs to raise the debt limit. If we don't raise the debt limit, it means that the president either needs to break the law and stop spending money that he's required to spend, or we need to stop paying our creditors, in which case there's a global financial crisis. So we need to raise the debt limit. But historically, the debt limit has almost always been used as an opportunity to take stock of our fiscal situation. It was how we got the deficit reduction agreements, Graham-Rubin-Hollings in the 1985-1987. It's how we got the 1990 budget deal. It's how we got deficit reduction in 1997 and 2011. So it's actually pretty normal to use the debt ceiling as an opportunity to have a fiscal conversation. There's just a difference between having a fiscal conversation and threatening default, and we cannot threaten default under any circumstance.
Talking to Mark Goldwein from the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, looking at the state of the debt, the annual deficit, and budget negotiations in the White House and Congress. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Jed is with us in Lacouture. Jed, hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
What did you want to bring up, Jed?
I'm just wondering if your speaker or you thought, when can we ever look at the Pentagon budget or the defense budget as something we can actually touch, as opposed to healthcare and education and childcare? When can we ever look at certain things and hopefully just find some monies there? Just, I don't know.
I got you, Jed. Thanks for the call. And that takes us down the path of specific budget lines. Mark, let's start there with the military. Are there opportunities for cuts? Are they politically realistic?
I think absolutely. There's a tremendous amount of waste in our defense budget on weapon systems that are only there because they benefit some company in some congressional district, on bureaucracies that don't make sense, you know, on base schools inside the United States where there's perfectly good public schools, commissaries, all sorts of ways. And then we could think more broadly about force structure, right? Do we really need the size of military? So that absolutely should be on the table. We did have some reductions in military spending in the 2011, 12, 13 period. But since 2017, Democrats and Republicans have basically come together with a you scratch my back, I scratch yours, where we've dramatically increased both military spending and non-defense spending by about 40% since 2017. So we're going in the wrong direction.
Thanks for that call, Jed, at 800-642-1234. We heard via email, Dave in Winona, Minnesota says, please ask the specifics of how they plan to do that, cut the deficit. They either have to cut Social Security, health care, or defense, or raise taxes. Let's talk about Social Security and Medicare, the so-called entitlements. How do they factor into all of this, Mark?
Well, look, Social Security and Medicare are the two largest federal government programs. Defense is about the same size as Medicare. And so I don't think you can have a serious plan to address the debt that doesn't look at Social Security and Medicare. With Medicare, the really good news is there are so many policies that can reduce cost without meaningfully reducing benefits. For example, there's these great private Medicare Advantage plans. They're actually very efficient, and yet they cost the federal government more than the less efficient public Medicare, basically because they're overcharging. So there's room to get savings there. There's room to get lower spending on drugs by encouraging the use of more generics instead of name brand drugs. There's room right now, if you go to, if you get dialysis in a dialysis center, Medicare pays less than if you do the exact same thing at a hospital. That doesn't make any sense. And so there's a ton of room for efficiencies in healthcare. And I do hope that's a place where the parties can come together, because both Presidents Obama and Trump proposed a lot of these reforms in their own budgets.
We're talking to Mark Goldwein at the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, looking at the national debt and the big choices in the current federal budget negotiations. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Cuts you do or don't want to see, tax changes you do or don't want to see, call in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Mark Goldwein, Senior Vice President and Senior Policy Director at the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, looking at the current state of the national debt. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Mark, before we go back to our callers, you have a thing on your group's website where people can play the home version of the federal budget. Can you tell us about the debt fixer program you have up there?
Yeah, absolutely. Go to crfp.org, and we actually have two very cool tools. One's called the debt fixer, and that lets you look at ways to cut defense, reform Social Security, lower healthcare costs, and raise taxes in order to get the debt on a more sustainable path. The other tool we have is called the Social Security Reformer. And I think as many folks know, Social Security is only about 10 years from insolvency, which means the trust fund is going to run out. The Reformer lets you adjust the benefit levels, the taxes coming in, the retirement age, to build your own plan to make Social Security sustainable and prevent that insolvency.
Got a link to the debt fixer up at WPR.org/Central Time. Back to your calls now. Rick is with us in Monona. Rick, hello. I'm sorry. Rick in Monona. Hi.
Hi. This isn't exactly cheering me up. It doesn't sound good. And my question is this. What if we don't deal with this? What is that a really dark future we're looking at?
Rick, you're asking a great question. I'm going to tell you the truth is we don't know. Let me tell you the best case scenario, which isn't all that great. The best case scenario is the United States, as the strongest economy in the world that borrows in our own currency, can stumble along like this forever. And in that scenario, the higher debt, it does something called crowd out investment. Basically, people buy bonds instead of investing in the private sector. So in that scenario, our economic growth just keeps slowing. Our wage growth keeps slowing. A larger and larger share of our budget goes to interest. In fact, interest is on course to be the single largest government program in 25 years' time, larger than defense, larger than Social Security. So the best case scenario is we stumble along, and this just cuts into our ability to grow and invest. The worst case scenario is we have a fiscal crisis. And the banking crisis we just saw a couple of weeks ago, is kind of a good microcosm of that. What we saw at Silicon Valley Bank was they had a bunch of low-yielding government bonds. And when the interest rate went up, those lost value, and then the banks lost value. Imagine a scenario where interest rates really spiked, so the value of portfolios around the globe were declining. That could cause a global financial crisis, a fiscal crisis, if you will. Something maybe that looks like the Great Recession or even worse.
Thanks for the call, Rick. Rod joins us now in La Crosse. Rod, hello.
Hello. I was an honorary discharge USMC 77. But I seen probably 10 years ago or maybe longer, maybe less. But I seen, I'm pretty sure it was a PBS broadcast they had on television. They had a pie on there. It showed how much everybody was getting. And they showed like welfare was like maybe a pinch, maybe an eighth of an inch on that pie. And then they sat there and they showed what they were given for, you know, taking care of roads and all this stuff. But more than three quarters of that was to the military. Now, that's all the taxpayers' money going to that military stuff. Now, when these guys sit there and they crash a jet that costs umpteen millions of dollars, why do they not sit there and have to pay that money back to the people they sit there and they just stole it from?
Rod, thanks for the call. Now, Mark, I'm assuming that graph was what we call discretionary income. I assume a chart that included Social Security and Medicare would look different. But Rod's point, military, a big piece of the pie.
That's right. I mean, military is large, and we need to find ways to rein in some of the spending, as I mentioned. But it's about 15% of the total budget. The largest share of the budget actually goes to seniors for Social Security and Medicare. In fact, the federal government spends $6 per senior for every $1 they spend for kids. And a lot of that makes sense because, we have a health and retirement program specifically designed to support seniors that they pay into. But it's also very costly, and those costs are getting larger as we get older as a population and as our healthcare costs continue to grow.
Thanks a lot for that call, Rod. Mark, something I wanted to ask you about before we run out of time. You testified, I believe, recently before Congress on the impact of the Biden administration's attempt to forgive at least some portion of student loan debt. What are you seeing there?
Yeah, so I don't think people are aware that not only has President Biden called for canceling $10,000 or $20,000 of debt per person, But they've also taken a lot of other measures, including changes to the income-driven repayment, a bunch of targeted cancellations, this long pause. We added them all up. It's almost $1 trillion. The student debt actions since the pandemic have cost $970 billion. That's actually more money than the federal government spent on higher education for its entire history prior to the pandemic. It's three times the cost of the Pell Grants. And when we've looked at what we're getting in return, a lot of this money is going to support doctors and lawyers and MBAs. The money looks like it's going to increase the rate of inflation, increase recession risk. Some of it's going to help people that really need it, but it's so poorly targeted that, in my opinion, and this is what I testified, I think it's really going to undermine the goals it's trying to achieve, make college more expensive and less affordable, and lower quality of education going forward.
And turning back to the big picture, Mark, bringing the deficit, the annual deficit down, putting a dent in that debt is going to require clearly cooperation between both parties in Congress and the White House. And people may hear that and say, so it's not going to happen at all. Do you have any sense of optimism that, in fact, that could happen?
Well, I'm optimistic on two fronts right now. The one is we have to decide how much to appropriate next year. And I do think we're going to stop this practice of Democrats getting a 10% non-defense cut. Democrats getting a 10% non-defense increase in exchange for Republicans getting a 10% defense increase. I think we are going to turn down the hose on the out-of-control appropriations. The other sense of optimism I have is that everybody understands healthcare costs are too high, and there's an increasingly good understanding of where those excessive costs are. And so I do think there's opportunity for us to come together to reduce excessive spending for certain types of providers, prescription drugs, Medicare Advantage. And if we did that, not only would that reduce the deficit, it would actually reduce premiums and out-of-pocket costs for seniors as well.
Mark, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Mark Goldwine, Senior Vice President and Senior Policy Director at the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. He joined us for a look at the latest on the national debt, the state of the federal budget deficit, and possible alternatives to bring it down. We have a link to that online debt fixer tool where you can come up with your own solutions at WPR.org/Central Time. In just 2 weeks, Wisconsin voters will choose a new state Supreme Court justice who will determine the ideological balance of the court for years to come. For a lot of voters, the right to access abortion is on the ballot. Anya Van Wagtendonk explains how the issue is bringing new energy to what might otherwise be a lower-key election.
On a freezing day in mid-March, several dozen rallygoers stand among snow piles in downtown Appleton. They're focused on rights they say are at stake in Wisconsin's pivotal state Supreme Court election. And for many in attendance, like Emma Keel, one issue stands out. That's because there's a good chance that whoever wins this election will hear a lawsuit over Wisconsin's abortion ban.
As a 26-year-old woman living in Wisconsin, I want to have autonomy over my body.
Wisconsin's court race has attracted national attention. Millions of dollars have poured in, and it's motivating voters like Whitney Bouchard, who might not normally be out in the cold for a race like this one.
This is new for me, yes. I've definitely supported Wisconsin politics in the past, but getting this involved is new to me, and I think I just realize how much of an impact these things have, and I don't think everybody does.
Ostensibly, this is a nonpartisan race, but the two candidates are favored by the two ends of the ideological spectrum. The conservative favorite, former Justice Dan Kelly, has done work for an anti-abortion group, while Judge Janet Protasiewicz has been outspoken in her support for abortion rights. Abortion's been outlawed here since last summer, when Roe v. Wade was overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court. That ruling reinstated a Wisconsin law first written in 1849 banning abortion. Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call has filed a lawsuit challenging Wisconsin's ban. It's expected to go before the state Supreme Court at some point after the winner of this election is sworn into office.
I think Wisconsin's going to be kind of like a laboratory for both sides as they try to figure out how to influence state Supreme Court elections.
Mary Ziegler is a leading historian of the U.S. abortion debate. She says abortion was not a top issue for most voters before last year, but that's changed, especially in a state like Wisconsin.
You also have seen, I think, a shift in intensity of preference on abortion among a lot of Democrats. And I think some questions among some Republicans, especially around laws like Wisconsin's that don't have, you know, don't have exceptions.
Ziegler says Wisconsin will be a model for other judiciary races going forward. Anti-abortion activists are aware of the stakes, and they're looking to preserve the legal victory they achieved last summer. Gracie Skogman, the legislative director of Wisconsin Right to Life, said she's never seen a response like this from anti-abortion activists.
This is the most impactful election for the pro-life base here in Wisconsin now that there is a tangible law that's on the line.
Douglas Keith is an attorney with the Brennan Center for Justice, which tracks spending in high court races. Keith says there's a reason the Wisconsin race has already shattered national records for spending.
Spending is increasing with the recognition that these courts are going to be the courts that are deciding some of the highest profile, most politically charged legal questions.
National groups have gotten involved in other ways, too. In January, the National Women's March held its flagship event in Madison to draw attention to the race. Jennifer Knox, the organizing director for Working Families Power, said the most important thing activists could do was invest some of their time in Wisconsin.
This is the single place in 2023 that really does reflect that abortion rights are on the ballot.
To hear Knox describe it, the stakes of the court race couldn't be more clear. She says whoever wins will decide whether abortion in Wisconsin is legal or not. Anya Van Wagtendonk, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up Monday here on Central Time, a major international report gives a dire warning about the impact of climate change without immediate action. Why are governments and political systems slow to respond? Wisconsin researchers join us to tackle that question. And people often receive aggressive and invasive medical care toward the end of life, even if they and their families don't want it. We'll dig into a new investigation on end-of-life care and tough decisions along the way. That's Monday on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farid. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we journey to Poland by way of Door County on this week's edition of Food Friday. First, if you have a dysfunctional family, you are not alone. Our families of origin can shape who we become and how we relate to others and move through the world. So when our families are dysfunctional, it can feel impossible to change, and that things like conflict, codependency, and pain are just the norm. Our next guest is a therapist and boundary-setting expert with advice for people dealing with dysfunctional family relationships. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you and family relationships in your life? How have you changed and healed? Did you find ways to improve those relationships, or did you make the choice to dial back or even end those relationships? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Nedra Glover-Tawab is a licensed therapist and a New York Times bestselling author. Her latest book is called Drama Free, A Guide to Managing Unhealthy Family Relationships. Nedra, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
You write, Nedra, that sometimes you hear from people, patients and others, that, you know what, family relationships, not such a big deal. That didn't shape who I am. You don't buy that. Can you talk about the importance of our families of origin in shaping who we are as people?
Yes, that's how we become ourselves. We learn so much by those early relationships and what we observe and also what we experience in those relationships. So it is very unlikely that we are existing in the world with no impact from our family.
Something I hadn't really thought of until I read your book is that if someone grows up in a dysfunctional family, that's all they've ever known. That may be all they see. They may not know it's dysfunctional in the first place. How do we, I guess, start to self-diagnose, like, hey, these things in my life are kind of dysfunctional?
You know, one way that I see us starting to diagnose this early is exposure. And that could be with TV, seeing different families on TV and how they interact. Sometimes your friends' families, maybe other healthier relationships within your family. Also, you know, as we get out into the world, you just see the world in a different light and you're able to say, whoa, something in my home is not normal or something with, you know, this family member is a bit off. So we have an opportunity to see other relationships and how people are able to show up in a much healthier way.
We're going to get into some specific kinds of dysfunction, what we can do about them. But there's some general pieces of advice that I think apply to a lot of people. Now, if we realize there's dysfunction, we have a few different choices. The easiest choice, and if I'm reading right, the wrongest choice is to say, yeah, whatever, that's life. We're just going to live with it. Can you talk about the importance of not just, you know, staying the course and living with this painful situation?
Yeah, living with it keeps you in the cycle of what's happening. And many of us want some sort of relief. We want some sort of resolution to the problem. And the way that we get that is by confronting some of these situations with people when it's possible. Now, there are some relationships where you've tried, you've placed a boundary, and the other person won't respect it. And then your choice may be to end the relationship. But there are many cases in which we're not talking enough. We're not having enough conversations around the problems in the family.
The toughest decision, I think, is to say, you know, this is a person who's been a huge part of my life, a sibling, a parent, you name it, and saying, but it's time to be done. What is the bar? How do we start to evaluate if it is time to say, you know what, it isn't worth the work anymore?
I think about the impact that the relationship is having on your life. Are you more anxious or more depressed, or do you feel unsafe in the relationship? Also, is there any effort from the other person to improve the relationship? Are they constantly, you know, doing certain things, or is it impossible for you to even view this situation from a different perspective? Because maybe it's, you know, the person is trying to do something different and we can't accept it because of what's been done. So it may be time to consider, you know, the relationship and the value it has in your life when you start to see that I can't exist in this anymore. It is more unhealthy for me to be in this than it is for me to leave the relationship.
Now, in a lot of ways, we're going to focus on the people who are at the receiving end of dysfunction, I think. Is there a way for people to look at themselves and figure out, am I the problem? Am I the dysfunctional one? Am I causing the people in my life pain? How do we self-diagnose and try to start moving out of that?
Yeah, I wonder, you know, if we were to look at how people respond to us, how people maybe commonly have issues with us. Usually when we are the person causing the problem, we've heard it from other people. We're just not listening. We have seen in our relationships that people are distant from us, or maybe they're estranged from us. And there is growth in just wondering why. Why don't people want to talk to you? Why might it be that this person is upset with you? And in that wondering, can you improve something? Can you repair something? Is there something salvageable in the relationship? You have to be open to seeing your role in the dysfunction.
We're talking to therapist Nedra Glover-Tawab about family dysfunction and how to deal with dysfunctional family relationships. Her newest book is called Drama Free, A Guide to Managing Unhealthy Family Relationships. You can join in with your thoughts, maybe your experiences, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Okay, Nedra, I've been talking in very vague terms here. You give a lot of specific cases and examples in your book. One situation might be, okay, an adult is looking at their parent who's had a history of alcoholism, and that's caused a lot of this dysfunction and pain. If the adult in that situation wants to bring that, to broach that with their parents, how do they start?
Just notice the problem. You know, your issue with alcohol has impacted me in the following ways, or even just placing boundaries. You know, when you come over my house, I want you to be sober. When you engage with my kids, I want you to be sober. I will not be coming to this thing because there will be some substance abuse there and I don't want to observe it or be a part of it. So sometimes we try to control the other person's behavior. Often we'll say to the person, you need to stop drinking, right? And that's a choice that person has to make. But what we can do in our lives is figure out, you know, if they're drinking, these are the things I will do. I will let them know that I have an issue with this, but it's not necessarily the case that I can change their behavior.
I can see the person being confronted being defensive. Do you have some strategies for whether we're confronting someone over alcohol or whatever it might be to, I don't know, hopefully not provoke that defensive response that's going to shut down the conversation right after it starts?
Yeah, you know, sometimes when people are not ready to receive information, they will be defensive no matter how we approach the conversation because they don't want to change. They don't want to hear the information. And so just hearing it overall, you know, especially with substance misuse, most people are like, no, I'm fine. I could quit whenever I want to. This is not a problem for me, even if it's a problem for you, because you're asking them to stop something that's not a choice at this point. It's an addiction, which means that they're unable to stop. So expecting the person to say, you know, maybe, oh, you're right. I've been abusing alcohol. Let me stop this today. That is idealistic. And maybe we should anticipate a bit of defensiveness, a bit of resistance, because that is likely what will happen. So when a person is defensive, we can stick to what we're saying. We don't have to, become oppositional or get into an argument with them. What we're seeing, it exists. It doesn't mean that this other person with the issue needs to validate the thing that is very clearly happening and often spoken about with multiple family members.
We're talking to therapist Nedra Glover-Tawab about her new book, Drama Free, A Guide to Managing Unhealthy Family Relationships. You can join in now at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest about dysfunction in families, how to manage that? Do you have an example that you'd be willing to share? If you're not willing, very understandable. But if you're willing to share a story from your own life where maybe you had one of these tough conversations with a family member, well, we'd sure appreciate it if you're willing to share that with us. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with therapist Nedra Glover-Tawab about her new book. It's called Drama Free, A Guide to Managing Unhealthy Family Relationships. If you have a story you'd like to share, an experience, a question maybe for our guest, you could join in at 800-642-1234. If you found a positive way to deal with a dysfunctional, a tough family relationship, definitely love to hear about that. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Now, Nedra, people aren't calling in, and I'm not really surprised because you even talk about this a little bit in the book. We're in a lot of ways trained not to talk about our unhealthy relationships, and that's maybe part of the problem. Can you talk about talking about these things?
Yeah, there's a lot of shame and also embarrassment. Sometimes we don't even know that other people are dealing with these issues because we aren't talking about it. It's not anything that comes up at a party, or it's not conversations that we typically have because we want to present as put together or as functional. It can be quite embarrassing. I've talked to many people who said, you know, I didn't want to have kids over to my house because of, you know, my dad's mood or, you know, my mom's wild behaviors. And I think sometimes that's not something we feel comfortable sharing. You know, we hear about that on podcasts, or we may hear about it on the radio or from brave individuals who share their story, but there is still a lot of silence around what happened in many of our families.
And in your book, you write that some of the signs of dysfunction sometimes are covering up problems that are there, denying that a problem exists, finding workarounds, as you said, so people don't see that dysfunction in action. And these, in a lot of ways, you say, are warning signs that we are, in fact, in a dysfunctional family.
Yeah. I mean, I think of, you know, like almost like we have like a Weekend at Bernie's sort of situation mm-hmm. with the dysfunction in our family. We just carry it around and put clothes on it, and we try to figure out all of these sort of things to mask the problem. Sometimes that includes enmeshing with people and being codependent and supporting some of their behaviors so it won't reflect so badly on us. we don't want everyone to know that, oh my gosh, this is the part of the system that I'm from. We want to appear as if we have it together. We have, you know, many ideas around how to work through things, when in actuality, many people struggle with their family relationships.
Another concern that you think about a lot, I know both in this book and in your previous work, is boundaries and boundary violations in our relationships. What do we mean by that?
Boundaries are expectations and needs that we have in relationships. And those violations can be any type of relationship. You know, I hear a lot about mother-in-laws and, you know, how they won't allow their children or, you know, their daughter-in-laws or son-in-laws to parent in a particular way. That is a boundary violation. You know, I think sometimes in sibling relationships, when you've always had a certain role in the family, you try to shift that maybe from being the, you know, the person everybody thought of as like funny and not taking anything seriously to being a full-fledged adult who's very aware of their life and who shows up differently. You know, that can be a really difficult conflict. So sometimes the conflict in families, it's not these big dysfunctional things like substance abuse and, you know, maybe physical abuse or sexual abuse and neglect. It could be, you know, I have some sibling rivalry with, you know, with my sister, or I have issues with how my partner parents his children. It could also be my in-laws are always in our stuff. There are so many ways that our dysfunction shows up.
I want to talk about concrete ways to set boundaries. And you give a really interesting example in the book, twin sisters, very close to each other, very much associated with each other. One of them's getting married, the other one unhappy with the decline in contact as the sister, the twin sister, you know, enters a new phase of life. And you give some examples from that for how to set up those boundaries in a polite but firm way. How did that work out?
Yeah, often with siblings, there is this level of enmeshment because they are so similar. Everyone sees them as the same person and they see themselves as, you know, sort of the same person. And so that sort of breaking away and going in different directions, be it, you know, one person wanting to move to a new city or attend a different college or even get married, those can be critical times in an enmeshed relationship. And you know, one person may have a big issue with that distinction between you and me. You're making this big choice. You're spending this time with this other person. And it is a difficult adjustment. And what makes it easier is when there are conversations around you wanting to build your own life separate from your identity of this twin sibling. I want to have a relationship with my husband. I want to raise my own children. I want to be in a different dynamic. And these are the ways in which I can make time for us. I still love you deeply. And I want to have other relationships that are important to me.
Talking to Nedra Glover-Tawab, licensed therapist and author of the new book, Drama Free, A Guide to Managing Unhealthy Family Relationships. Related to that, I think in some ways, a common scenario in healing from dysfunctional family relationships is that, you know, you change, one person might change, but the rest of the family doesn't, which can be kind of a lonely experience. What do people do if they've done the work to change, but then they go back to visit family and things are still all the same there?
Yeah, you have to really pick your energy. And I think sometimes that might mean, you know, staying in a hotel and staying instead of staying in the house with people. It might mean shorter visits. It could mean maybe not visiting at all. You know, there are some people who can tolerate it for a certain length of time. And there are others who say, I just can't go back there because of what the situation is. So you choose, you know, what works for you, and you notice your energy in those situations. It's very hard to give a prescriptive sort of way of existing in a situation where you are the only person who has noticed and is responding to the problem. In dysfunctional families, they remain dysfunctional because no one is willing to change anything. That is the dysfunction, being unchanged. So when someone has an issue and everybody wants to stay the same, it can be very sad to watch people stay in circumstances that are not serving them well.
I want to spend some time on a specific group, people who are becoming parents, and those parents grew up in dysfunctional families themselves. And I've heard this from friends over the years. My parents did blank, and I want to make sure I don't do blank as a parent myself. How do people check themselves and try not to replicate that thing that they grew up with, the model of parenting that they literally experienced growing up?
It takes a lot of intentional practice and patience, because as you are learning to parent, you are also revisiting spaces of your childhood. You know, as you're pregnant, that may bring up things for you. As your child, you know, has these various moments in life, it's like, oh my gosh, I didn't receive this. So I think there's a lot of healing and parenting growth that's happening simultaneously that you will have to make space for. And sometimes that is best done with, you know, a therapist, your partner. It can look many different ways, but it is quite the experience to raise children in a healthy environment when your environment was not healthy and you're having to teach yourself a lot of tools that you never knew.
You give some practical advice for parents there on raising kids who are, you know, emotionally healthy and primed to have functional relationships. You know, as a parent myself, in the moment, you're not always thinking things through super carefully. But what are some things to watch out for, some things that are going to shut down those positive emotional responses?
Adults telling kids how to show up in the world and exist. You know, many adults, including myself sometimes, you know, we make mistakes in how we talk to or treat kids. Kids are, you know, little people with big feelings. And sometimes because of our reflection point as adults, we forget that they're children and they do have a perspective. So if we want them to be assertive beings, they have to be assertive with the adults in their lives. They have to be able to share their story with you. They have to be able to have a level of openness. They have to be able to explore how boundaries can and can't work for them. So there are so many things emotionally that they need that adults have the perspective to potentially help them with when we're open to raising emotionally aware and adjusted children.
In just our last minute or so, Nedra, when do we decide, you know what, this is a little more than I can deal with, I need to seek out a therapist or other form of outside help to help me through this situation?
When we've been trying to do it on our own and we're not getting any further, it is time to now seek a therapist. Often we will keep trying over and over. I keep doing this thing and it's not working. And that's a sign that perhaps you don't have the tools. Maybe you don't know exactly what needs to be done. Maybe you need someone to hold space for you to hear about, you know, how you're doing this. Therapy can be a support. It's not just for people in crisis. It's also for people who need support and maybe someone to listen to them as they're processing a lot of this new stuff.
Nedra, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
You're welcome.
That was therapist and author Nedra Glover-Tawab. She talked to us about her new book. It's called Drama Free, A Guide to Managing Unhealthy Family Relationships. Coming up after the news, it's this week's edition of Food Friday, and we're talking to Door County's Prince of Pierogi, Christoph Kroll, about the cuisine of his native Poland. And if you have questions about Polish food or experiences, maybe you're even making some this weekend. Love to hear from you. Email ideas@WPR.org, post on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or hang out and call in at 800-642-1234. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.